Frontline presents the New York Times bestselling book, The Harbinger, read to you by the author, Jonathan Cahn.
Chapter 1, An Ancient Mystery. An ancient mystery that holds the secret of America's future. Yes. What would I think? Yes. What would you think? I'd think it was a plot for a movie. Is that it? Is that what you're presenting? A movie manuscript? No. A plot for a novel? No. Then what? He was silent. Then what? She repeated. He paused to carefully consider what he was about to say, and how to say it. Her reputation among those in media was that of a woman who neither wasted her time nor indulged those who did. She was not known to suffer fools gladly. The discussion could meet an abrupt end at any given moment, and there would be no second chance with her. The fact that there had even been a meeting in the first place, that she had even agreed to it, and that he was now sitting in her office, high above the streets of Manhattan, was nothing short of a miracle, and he knew it. He had only one concern, the message. It didn't even occur to him to remove his black leather overcoat, nor had anyone offered to remove it for him. Leaning forward in his chair, he gave her his answer, slowly, cautiously, carefully deliberating every word. An ancient mystery that holds the secret of America's future, and on which its future hangs. And it's not fiction, it's real. She was quiet. At first he took the silence as a positive sign, an indication that he was getting through. But then she spoke and quickly dispelled the notion. An Indiana Jones movie, she said. An ancient mystery hidden for thousands of years under the sands of the Middle East, but now revealed, and upon it hangs the fate of the entire world. Her flippancy provoked him to become all the more resolute. But it's not fiction, he repeated. It's real. What would I say? She asked. Yes, what would you say? I'd say you were crazy. Perhaps I am, he said with a slight smile. Nevertheless, it's real. If you're not crazy, then you're joking, or you're doing this all for a dramatic effect, part of a presentation, but you can't be serious. But I am serious. She paused for a moment, staring into the eyes of her guest, attempting to ascertain whether he was sincere or not. So you are, she said. So I am, he replied, and you have no idea how much so. It was then that her expression changed. Up to that point, it had suggested a trace of amused interest. It now turned to that of total disengagement. No, I guess I don't. Listen, I believe you're a sincere man, but I'm really very busy, and I don't have time for... Mrs. Goren. That's Goren. The accent's on the last syllable, but Anna is fine. Anna, you have nothing to lose by listening. Just go on the slight possibility that you're not crazy. That too, he said. But the slight possibility that what I'm saying could actually be true. Even the slight possibility that there could be something in what I'm telling you. Even for that slightest of possibilities. For just that, it would be important enough to warrant your time. You need to hear me out. She sat back in her chair and stared at him, making no attempt to hide her skepticism. You still think I'm crazy? Fully, she said. For argument's sake, let's say you're right, I am crazy. Indulge me, as a public service. She smiled. I'll indulge you, Mr. Kaplan, but there's a limit. Noriel, you can call me Noriel. At that, she got up from her chair and motioned for him to do likewise. She led him away from her desk to a small round conference table, where the two sat down. The table was situated in front of a huge glass window, through which one could see a vast panorama of skyscrapers with similar windows, each reflecting the light of the afternoon sun. All right, Noriel, tell me about your mystery. It's not my mystery. It's much bigger than me. You have no idea how big or what it involves. And what does it involve? Everything. It involves everything, and it explains everything. Everything that's happened, that's happening, and everything that's going to happen. What do you mean? Behind September 11th. How could an ancient mystery possibly have anything to do with September 11th? an ancient mystery behind everything from 9/11 to the economy, to the housing boom, to the war in Iraq, to the collapse of Wall Street, everything in precise detail. How? How could an ancient mystery possibly affect your life, your bank account, your future? But it does, and it holds the key to America's future, to the rise and fall of nations, to world history. And it's not only a mystery, it's a message, an alarm. An alarm, she asked. An alarm of what? Of warning. To whom? America. Why? When you hear it, he said, you'll understand why. All this from a mystery that goes back... How far did you say? I didn't say. So how far back does it go? 2,500 years. A 2,500-year-old mystery behind what's happening in the 21st century, from politics to the economy to foreign affairs, all that, and you're the only one who knows about it? I'm not the only one. Who else knows about it, she asked. There's at least one other. Not the government? The government has no idea, even though it's behind all that? As far as I know, no government, no intelligence agency, no one else. No one but you, and at least one other. And how did you happen to discover it? I didn't discover it, he answered. It was given to me. Given? By whom? A man. And who was this man? It's hard to say. At this she leaned forward and spoke to him in a tone both intense and slightly sarcastic. Try me, she said. You won't understand. What was his name? I don't know. You don't know? She replied, with a trace of amusement in her voice. No, he never told me. So this earth-shattering mystery is known only by you and this one man who gave it to you but doesn't have a name. I didn't say he didn't have a name, he just never told it to me. And you never asked? I did, but he never told me. No phone number? He never gave me one. No business card? No. Not even an email? I don't expect you to believe me yet. Why not? She replied, making no attempt to hide her skepticism. It sounds so plausible. But hear me out. So this man with no name gives you this mystery. That's correct. And why do you? I guess I was the right one. So you were chosen? I guess so, he replied, his voice trailing off. And where did he get the mystery from? I don't know. A mystery on which the nation's future is hanging, and no one knows where it came from. From where do prophets get their messages? Prophets, she said. So now we're talking prophets. I guess we are. As in Isaiah, Jeremiah, something like that. The last time I heard about prophets, I was in Sunday school, Noriel. Prophets don't exist anymore. They've been gone for ages. How do you know? So you're telling me that the man who gave you this revelation is a prophet? Something like that. He told you he was a prophet? No, he never came out and said it. And you believe all this because it came from a prophet? No, he answered. It wouldn't have mattered who said it. It's not about the messenger. It's about the message. So why are you telling me all this? Why did you come here? I'm not exactly known for dealing with anything remotely like this. Because the stakes are so high. Because the future is hanging on it. Because it affects millions of people. And you think I have a part in this? I do. Really? Yes. She leaned back in her chair and stared at him for a moment, intrigued, amused, and still trying to figure him out. So, Noriel, tell me how it all began. He reached into his coat pocket, laid his closed hand down on the table, then opened it. In the middle of his palm was a small object of reddish, golden-brown clay, circular and about 2 inches in diameter. It all began with this. He handed it to her. She began examining it. The more she looked at it, the more intrigued she became. It was covered with what appeared to be ancient inscriptions. It all began with this. And what is it? It's a seal, he answered. It's the first seal. Chapter 2. The Prophet. A seal, she repeated, as she continued her examination of the object in her hands. And what exactly is a seal? It's what they used in ancient times to mark a document as authentic or authoritative. She laid it down on the table. And the markings? Letters, he said. Paleo-Hebrew engravings. Paleo-Hebrew? I've never heard of it. It's an ancient form of Hebrew script. Are you some kind of an archaeologist? No, he replied. A journalist, a freelance journalist. Wait a minute. Kaplan. Noriel Kaplan. I knew the name was familiar. You've done pieces in magazines and on the internet. Guilty. Why didn't it hit me before? She shook her head back and forth in her amazement over not having recognized the name at the start. So you're not crazy after all, she said, almost apologetically. Some would disagree with such a presumption, he answered. At that, her demeanor and tone became markedly less guarded. But this has to be a departure for you. How did you get involved with it? This is how, he said, lifting the clay seal from the table. This is what began everything. How did you get it? Believe it or not, it came in the mail. You ordered it? No, I didn't order it, and I wasn't expecting it. It just came. A small brown package with my name and address, and no return address. Inside was this ancient-looking seal, nothing else, no letter of explanation, nothing. And what did you think? I didn't know what to think. What was I supposed to make of it? It had no connection to anything in my life. Who would have sent it to me with no explanation? I put it away. But it continued to intrigue me. One day, it was late afternoon, I found myself unable to stop thinking about it. I decided to go outside for some fresh air. I put the seal in my coat pocket and went for a walk along the Hudson River. It was a windy day. The sky was dark, filled with ominous-looking clouds. After some time, I sat down on one of the benches overlooking the water. I took out the seal and began examining it. I wasn't alone on the bench. There was a man sitting to my left. "Looks like a storm," he said, without turning to me or interrupting his gaze, which was fixed on the sky above the water. "It does," I replied. That's when he decided to look, first at me and then at the seal in my hand. And that's when the intensity of his gaze first struck me. "What's that?" he asked. "Some archaeological artifact." "May I see it?" he said. "I promise to be careful." I was reluctant, but for some reason, thinking back, I don't know exactly why, I agreed to his request. He began examining its details. "Do you have any idea what it is?" I asked. "Where did you get it?" "Why, it's very interesting. It's an ancient seal." "Which is what?" he continued. "Seals like this one were used to mark important documents, edicts, decrees, communications by kings, rulers, princes, priests, and scribes in ancient times. The seal was the sign of authenticity. It would let you know that the message was real, from someone important, and to be taken seriously." "What about the writing?" "It's in ancient Paleo-Hebrew, from, I would say, the 6th to 7th century BC. "How did you get it?" "Someone sent it to me." "Who?" "I don't know." He removed his gaze from the object just long enough to make eye contact with me, as if surprised by my response. "You don't know who sent it to you?" "No." "Someone just sent you this in the mail?" "How do you know so much about it?" "About seals?" "Yes. Ancient objects are a hobby of mine." "It's Judean." "Judean? The seal is from the kingdom of Judah." "And that's significant?" "Very. It's where most of the Bible came from, the kingdom of Judah, Israel. There was never a people for whom the authenticity of a written word meant so much. For them, it was a matter of life or death. You see, God spoke to them. He sent them words, prophetic messages of correction, messages to save them from calamity. If they ignored such a message, the result would be catastrophic. And God sent these words how? Through his messengers, through his servants, the prophets. And how exactly would he send these messages? The prophet would receive the word through impartation, a vision, a dream, an utterance, a sign. He would then be responsible to deliver the word to the nation, either by proclaiming it or by committing it to writing, or by performing a prophetic act. And how would the nation know if a word came from God or not, if it was authentic? How would you recognize an authentic prophet? It wouldn't be by his appearance, he said, if that's what you mean. He wouldn't necessarily look any different from anyone else, except that he was called. He could be a prince or a farmer, a shepherd, a carpenter. He could be sitting right next to you, and you'd have no idea you were sitting next to a prophet. It wasn't about the prophet, but about the one who sent him. So then how would they know if the message was from God? It would contain the mark, the fingerprint of the one who sent it. Like a seal, Yes, like a seal. And the word would come at the appointed time, when the nation needed to hear it, in critical times, and in times of apostasy and danger. Danger? Of judgment, he replied. And would they listen to the prophets? Some would, most would not. They preferred to hear pleasant messages, but the messages of the prophets weren't meant to make them feel good, but to warn them. So the prophets were persecuted, and then came judgment, calamity, destruction. He handed me back the seal. It was him, said Anna, breaking her silence. The man on the bench, he was the prophet. Yes, he was letting you know that when he said he could be sitting right next to you. Exactly. What did he look like? Somewhat thin, dark hair, a closely cropped beard. He was Mediterranean or Middle Eastern looking. And what was he wearing? A long dark coat. He was always wearing the same coat every time I saw him. So he handed you back the seal. Yes, and I asked him, so why would anyone want to send me an ancient seal? A seal, he said, bears witness to a message that it's authentic or that it's of great importance. But what would that have to do with me, I asked. I don't have anything to do with messages of great importance. Maybe you do, and just don't know it. You're very mystical, you know. Or maybe, he said, you're about to receive one. What do you mean? A message of great importance, he replied. His left hand had been resting on his lap for the entire length of the conversation, closed. That's when he opened it. In the middle of his palm was a seal. No, said Anna, now leaning forward in her chair. How could he have? But he did. A seal like yours? Like mine, except with different markings. But how did he? Exactly. That's what I wanted to know. I couldn't think straight. I couldn't process it. My heart was pounding, and my voice grew tense. What's that? I asked. I knew what it was, but I didn't know how else to say it. A seal, he replied. What I meant was, what are you doing with a seal? What am I doing with a seal? The question is, what are you doing with a seal? How did you get that? I countered. I told you. It's my hobby. I collect them. You collect seals? Yes. You're the one, I said, my voice filled with tension and rising. You're the one behind it. You're the one who sent it to me. What is this all about? It's all about finding out what it's all about. How did you do this? How did you manage to... You've been following me? Following you? I was the one sitting on the bench. You're the one who came after. Are you sure you weren't following me? I don't even know you. Nevertheless, you were the one who came after. He was right, of course. He couldn't have been following me. He was already there. I was the one who sat down next to him. And yet in his hand was a seal just like the one in mine, as if he knew I would come, as if he had been waiting. But it was a rare thing for me to go there. It wasn't planned. And I was the one who chose to sit down at that particular bench and to take out the seal at that particular moment. I asked him again, what is this all about? You've been given a seal, he said. Where there's a seal, there must be a message. Do you have a message? No, I replied, almost defensively. I don't have any message. At that, he paused and just stared for a few moments into the distance. Then he turned to me and, looking directly into my eyes, uttered his reply. But I do. What do you mean? I asked. But I do have a message. What message? I have a message for you. At that point, I was almost shaking. I got up from the bench. I don't think so, I said in a voice now tense with anxiety. I have no idea how you managed to do this, but it has nothing to do with me. It's the time, he replied. I wanted to run, but I couldn't. I was torn between two impulses, the urge to get as far away from that bench as I could and the need to hear what he had to say. I was frozen, and then he spoke again. It's the time, Noriel. Noriel, I replied, almost shouting. How did you... How could he have possibly known your name? Anna interjected. A good question, but he never answered it. Instead, he turned his gaze back to the distance ahead and continued speaking. It's the appointed time, but not for an ancient nation. It's time for the word to be given, for the mystery to be revealed, for the message to go forth. It's the appointed time, but not for an ancient nation. This has nothing to do with me, I said again. Then why were you given the seal? He asked. Who are you? I countered. He didn't answer that, but just looked at me. It was a silence as intense as anything else that took place that day. I couldn't stay there any longer. So you left him? She asked. Yes. And what did he do when you left? I don't know. I didn't look back. So how did you make sense of all that? I didn't. I went home. But I couldn't stop thinking about it. For days, it was almost impossible to sleep. I picked up a Bible to look for anything I could find on the prophets and their messages. Days went by, weeks, and I could hardly think of anything but that encounter. And then I returned. To the bench by the Hudson. Yes, but not exactly to the bench, but near it, to where I could see it from a distance. Why? Because I wasn't sure I wanted to see him again. But you did want to see him again. Again, I was torn. I knew that if I didn't see him again, I'd never know the answer. At the same time, I was afraid of what that might mean. And yet, still, I was drawn back. I had to return. And he wasn't there. I returned a second time, and again he wasn't there. And then a third time. And the third time he was there, just as he was the first time, sitting on the same bench, on the same spot, in the same long dark coat. And then it began. Chapter 3. Kingdom's Eve and the Nine Harbingers. I was standing behind the bench and to the right. You returned, said the prophet, without any movement of his head, but still maintaining his gaze into the distance. He couldn't possibly have seen me, but he knew I was there. It was something I could never get used to, being with someone you felt could at any given time see through you. Why, he asked, still gazing toward the waters. Why did you return? Because, I replied, you're the only one who can give me the answer. To what, he asked. To the problem. To what problem? To the problem of you. I'm the only one who can answer the problem of me, he said with a hint of playfulness in his voice. I don't know, Noriel. It sounds like a paradox to me. Am I wrong, I asked. No, he replied, you're not wrong. I joined him on the bench. It was only then that he broke his gaze to look at me. But are you ready, he asked. For the answer. I hope so. Then let's begin. You're a journalist. Did you bring a notepad or a recording device? A recording device. Good, he said. I thought you would have. Turn it on. I removed the recorder from my coat pocket and pressed record. From then on, I was even more careful to make sure I never went anywhere without it, just in case. So then everything the prophet said you recorded? Asked Anna. Virtually everything. Recordings of the Prophet. Not a bad title for a book. As soon as I turned it on, he returned his gaze back to the waters and slightly upward, focusing on no particular object as far as I could see. Then he began to speak, as if recalling some distant memory. They had no idea what was coming. They thought it would all go on as it always had, as if it would never change. They had no idea what was about to happen, or what it was all leading to. Everything they had ever known up to that point, their entire world would vanish. Who? An ancient people, an ancient kingdom, Israel, the Northern Kingdom, 8th century BC. They should have known. It was all there from the beginning, but they forgot. Forgot what? Their purpose, their foundation, that which made them unique. No other nation had been called into being for the will of God, or dedicated to his purposes from conception. No other people had been given a covenant, but the covenant had a condition. If they followed the ways of God, they would become the most blessed of nations. But if they fell away and turned against his ways, then their blessings would be removed and replaced by calamity, as they did, and as it was. But why would they turn away if they were given so much? It's a mystery, said the prophet, a kind of spiritual amnesia. When it began, they were still using God's name, but with less and less meaning behind it. Then they started merging him, confusing him with the gods of the nations. And then they began turning against him, subtly at first, then outright, then brazenly, driving him out of their national life and bringing in idols to fill the void. The land became covered with idols and altars to foreign gods. They rejected their covenant, abandoned their standards, and exchanged the values they had always lived by for those they had never known, spirituality for sensuality, holiness for profanity, and righteousness for self-interest. They cut themselves off from the faith on which their nation had been established and became strangers to God. And as for their most innocent, their little children, they offered them up as sacrifices. Literally, I asked. They literally killed their own children? On the altars of Baal and Molech, their newfound gods. That's how far they descended. Everything was now upside down. What they had once known as right, they now saw as outdated, intolerant, and immoral. And what they had once known as immoral, they now championed and celebrated as sacred. They had transformed themselves into the enemies of the God they had once worshipped and the faith they had once followed, until the very mention of his name was banned from their public squares. And yet, in spite of all this, he was merciful and called to them again and again. Through the prophets? Through the prophets, Elijah, Elisha, Hosea, and Amos, pleading with them, warning them, calling them to return. But they rejected the call and declared war on those who remained faithful. They branded them as troublemakers, irritants, dangerous, and finally, enemies of the state. They were marginalized, vilified, persecuted, and even hunted down. So the nation grew deaf to the call of those trying to save them from judgment. The alarm would have to grow louder, and the warnings more severe. More severe? They would enter a new stage. The words of the prophets would now be joined to the sound of calamity. God would remove the hedge. Remove what hedge? I asked. The hedge he had placed around them. The hedge of protection, of national security, that had kept them safe up to that point. As long as it was in place, they were safe. No enemy kingdom, no empire, no power on earth could touch them. But once it was removed, everything changed. Their enemies could now enter, breach their land, and enter their gates. It was a new phase, much more dangerous than before. Thus began the days of calamities and shakings, the days of final warning. And when did all this happen? When was this hedge removed? 732 BC. Maybe I'm missing something, I said. But what does all this, what happened 2,500 years ago, have to do with anything, with now? What does it have to do with why you're here and why I'm listening to all this? When we first met, you said it wasn't about an ancient nation, but so far all you've talked about is an ancient nation. I said, not for an ancient nation. That's different. But why are you talking about an ancient nation? Because unless you understand what happened then, you'll never understand what's happening now. Now. So it's some kind of key. A key for the appointed time, for the word to be given, and for the message to go forth, but not for an ancient nation. Then for what? For what nation? He was silent. I asked him again, then for what nation? It was only then that he voiced it. America, he said. Now for America. With that, he got up from the bench and walked over toward the water. I couldn't let it go at that. I followed him there. All this has to do with America? Yes. So it's the appointed time for America? For a mystery to be revealed and a message to be given to America? Yes. But what does America have to do with ancient Israel? Israel was unique among nations in that it was conceived and dedicated at its foundation for the purposes of God. Okay. But there was one other, a civilization also conceived and dedicated to the will of God from its conception. America. In fact, those who laid its foundations, the founding fathers? No, long before the founding fathers. Those who laid America's foundations saw it as a new Israel, an Israel of the new world. And as with ancient Israel, they saw it as in covenant with God. Meaning? Meaning its rise or fall would be dependent on its relationship with God. If it followed his ways, America would become the most blessed, prosperous, and powerful nation on earth. From the very beginning, they foretold it. And what they foretold would come true. America would rise to heights no other nation had ever known. Not that it was ever without fault or sin, but it would aspire to fulfill its calling. What calling? To be a vessel of redemption, an instrument of God's purposes, a light to the world. It would give refuge to the world's poor and needy, and hope to its oppressed. It would stand against tyranny. It would fight more than once against the dark movements of the modern world that threatened to engulf the earth. It would liberate millions. And as much as it fulfilled its calling or aspired to, it would become the most blessed, the most prosperous, the most powerful, and the most revered nation on the earth, just as its founders had prophesied. But there's a but coming, isn't there? Yes, he replied. There was always another side to the covenant. If ancient Israel fell away from God and turned against his ways, its blessings would be removed and replaced with curses. But wasn't Israel surrounded by nations far worse, I asked, with no concept of God or moral code? So why would Israel be judged? Because to whom much is given, much is required, and no nation had ever been given so much. None had been so spiritually blessed, so the standards were higher, the stakes greater, and the judgment, when it came, more severe. And America, I said, and America has done much good, and there's no shortage of nations far exceeding any of its faults or sins. But no nation in the modern world has ever been given so much. None has been so blessed. To whom much is given, much is required. If a nation so blessed by God should turn away from him, what then? Its blessings will be replaced with curses? Yes. And has America turned away from God? I asked. It has turned and is turning. How? In the same way Israel turned. It started with a spiritual complacency, then spiritual confusion, then the merging of God with idols, and then, ultimately, the rejection of his ways. Just as with ancient Israel, America began ruling God out of its life, turning step by step against his ways, at first subtly, and then more and more brazenly. When, I asked, when did it start? There's no one simple answer. In America's greatest moments, there was always sin, and in its worst moments, greatness. But there are critical junctures. In the middle of the 20th century, America began officially removing God from its national life. It abolished prayer and scripture in its public schools. As ancient Israel had removed the Ten Commandments from its national consciousness, so America did likewise, removing the Ten Commandments from public view, banning it from its public squares, and taking it down by government decree from its walls. As it was in ancient Israel, so too in America, God was progressively driven out of the nation's public life. The very mention of the name God or Jesus in any relevant context became more and more taboo and unwelcome, unless for the purpose of mockery and attack. That which had once been revered as sacred was now increasingly treated as profanity. And as God was driven out, idols were brought in to replace him. But Americans don't worship idols. No, said the prophet, they just don't call them idols. As God was expunged from American life, idols came in to fill the void. Idols of sensuality, idols of greed, of money, success, comfort, materialism, pleasure, sexual immorality, self-worship, self-obsession. The sacred increasingly disappeared, and the profane took its place. It was another kind of spiritual amnesia. The nation forgot its foundations, its purpose, and its calling. The standards and values it had long upheld were now abandoned. What it had once known as immoral, it now accepted. Its culture was increasingly corrupted by the corrosion of sexual immorality, growing continuously more crude and vulgar. A wave of pornography began penetrating its media. The same nation that had once been dedicated to spreading God's light to the nations now filled the world with the pornographic and the obscene. Some would call it tolerance, I said. Yes, he replied, the same tolerance that overtook ancient Israel. A tolerance for everything opposed to God, a growing tolerance for immorality, and a growing intolerance for the pure, a tolerance that mocked, marginalized, and condemned those who remained faithful to the values now being discarded. Innocence was ridiculed, and virtue was vilified. Children were taught of sexual immorality in public schools while the word of God was banned. It was a tolerance that put the profane on public display and removed nativity scenes from public sight, contraband, as if somehow they had become a threat, a strangely intolerant tolerance. But still, I countered, how does all that compare to what happened in ancient Israel? America doesn't offer its children on altars of sacrifice. Does it not? He said. 10 years after removing prayer and scripture from its public schools, the nation legalized the killing of its unborn. The blood of the innocent now stained its collective hands. Israel had sacrificed thousands on the altars of Baal and Molech, but by the dawn of the 21st century, America had sacrificed millions. For its thousands, judgment came upon Israel. What then of America? So what are you saying? He didn't respond. Is America in danger of judgment? I asked. Again, he was silent. Tell me, is America in danger of judgment? Are you sure you want to know the answer? I'm sure. The answer to your question is yes. Yes, America is in danger of judgment. I didn't respond immediately. I was trying to come up with a defense. Finally, I said, it can't be as bad as it was in ancient Israel. They came against the prophets. But if God sent a message today to America calling it back, people would listen. Would they? They wouldn't? No. How do you know? Because they've deafened their ears to those voices. So as with ancient Israel, the alarm would have to grow louder and the calling more severe. Which means what? Which means that America would enter a new stage. Of what? Of what happened to Israel, he answered. The hedge? The removal of the nation's hedge of protection. And what would it mean if something like that would happen? There was a long pause before he answered that. It already has. What do you mean? America's hedge has already been removed, and the 9 harbingers have been manifested. The 9 harbingers? The 9 harbingers that manifested in ancient Israel in the nation's last days. Each one was a sign. Each one was a warning of judgment, of their end, the 9 harbingers of judgment. I don't understand. It's all happening again, according to the same pattern, according to the judgment of ancient Israel. The 9 harbingers that appeared in the last days of ancient Israel are now appearing in America. Appearing in America? Each one manifesting on American soil, each one containing a prophetic message. And upon these, the future of the nation hangs. I don't understand. You don't have to understand. It will all be revealed. He asked me if I had the seal. I did. I removed it from my pocket and handed it to him. He then opened up his other hand to reveal another seal, the same one he was holding the day we met. He placed it in my hand. 9 seals, 1 for each harbinger. 1 for each mystery. And this one, I asked? This is the seal of the first harbinger. And the one I gave you? That was your seal. But as for the seals of the harbingers, there are 8 more. You'll keep each seal until we meet again, at which time you'll return it to me to receive the next seal and the next revelation. You'll only have 1 seal at a time, the security deposit of a coming mystery. And you trust me to give it back to you, I asked. Yes, but how do you know you'll ever see me again? You're the one seeking, and you won't stop until you find. In any case, I have my own security deposit. Don't I? He paused, and then, slightly nodding his head, said, until then, Noriel, and he began to walk away. And my seal? I shouted after him. You'll get it back when we're finished, he replied, without stopping or turning his head. And when will we meet again? I asked. When it's time to speak of the first harbinger. Here? At the appointed place, he replied. How will I know? How did you know to come here in the first place? He asked. I didn't. So you won't know again, and yet you'll be there. And then he was gone. Chapter 4 The First Harbinger, The Breach. But you did see the prophet after that? Yes. And you didn't have any contact with him before you saw him again? That's right. I don't understand, she said. How did you know where to meet him, or when, if he never told you? I didn't know where or when, he replied. We just met. I still don't get it. It would just happen. Sometimes I'd be led by the clues, and sometimes I'd be led in spite of them. Even when I got them wrong, I'd still end up in the right place eventually. And sometimes, even with no clues, when I wasn't even searching, it would still happen. We just ended up in the same place. Call it predestination. I don't know. It just happened. Why do you think the prophet gave you clues to put together instead of just telling you from the start? I don't know. Maybe because it was the process of trying to put it all together that led to the next encounter. I think it was also so that each harbinger would be burned into my consciousness. So you met him again, and what happened? No, wait a minute. She got up from the table, walked over to her desk, and pressed one of the buttons on her phone set. Hold off any incoming calls, she said. Don't allow any interruptions. Even the calls that are scheduled, replied a woman's voice on the speakerphone. Yes, tell them something came up, and that I'll get back as soon as possible. Apologize for me, warmly. For how long? I don't know, she said, for the rest of the day. She returned to the table and refocused her attention. Okay, so you met him again, she said. When and where? It was weeks after our last encounter. During that time, I studied the seal, looking for clues to the mystery of the first harbinger. And what was on it? Markings and shapes, but one that was clearly the central image and the largest. It was, how can I describe it? There was a horizontal line, as if it was the top border of some object or structure. The line dipped down in the middle of the seal, then back up again, then continued as a horizontal line to the other side. So it formed something like a V in the middle. I couldn't make anything out of it. So I went back to the bench by the water, but he wasn't there. I went back several more times after that, but nothing. More weeks went by, and then months. I wondered if I'd ever see him again, and the whole thing still didn't seem real. I would have almost doubted my memory if it wasn't for the seal. One day, it was a Tuesday morning, I was in Lower Manhattan, the very bottom of the island, in Battery Park, pondering the words of the prophet and looking across the waters at the Statue of Liberty in the distance. At first, I didn't notice it, a dark figure standing about 50 feet in front of me and to the right. It was him. He was also facing the water, so I could only see his back. Whether he was looking at the statue or at some other object, or just at the water, I don't know. He turned to the side, just for a moment. That's when I recognized him. I made my way over to him as fast as I could, not wanting to risk missing the moment. While I was still in back of him, he spoke, again without breaking his gaze, at least at first. Noriel, he said. Present, I replied, and just on time. Did you arrange that too, I asked. No. Have you studied the seal? I have. And what did you find? Nothing. Did you bring your recorder? It's always with me. Then let's begin, he said, turning to gaze toward me for the first time in the exchange. A warm breeze ruffled his hair as he spoke, above the sound of seagulls in the background. Take out the seal, he said. What do you see? Inscriptions, symbols, and one main symbol. What do you make of it? I don't know. It's something like a V. It's an image, Noriel. Of what? The top of a wall, he said. It's a wall of protection. And what's the V in the middle? Not a V, he replied. A breach. A breach? A gap, a break, an opening in the wall. The wall is broken, the sign that an enemy has entered in. It's the removing of the hedge of protection. It's what happened to ancient Israel? Yes, with no other way of getting through to them. The hedge of protection is removed. The year is 732 BC. Israel's enemies invade the land and wreak havoc. The calamity traumatizes the nation, but it takes place on a limited scale. The enemy strikes and then withdraws. It's a foreshadowing of something much greater and much more severe, a warning, a harbinger of a future judgment so great that if it ever came to pass, the nation would never recover. So the warning is the removal of the hedge. Yes, said the prophet. A late-stage warning, allowed to take place only when nothing else would wake them up. Limited, restrained, the sound of an alarm for the purpose of averting a much greater calamity. It never could have happened had Israel remained inside the will of God. No enemy could ever have breached its walls. But outside the will of God, any notion of national security or invincibility was an illusion. The breach exposed it. The nation was in danger. It would be shaken to its foundation. And apart from returning to God, there was no wall strong enough to protect them. It was their wake-up call. So they never woke up? No, he replied. Most would see the tragedy as a matter of defense, national security, or foreign policy. They committed themselves to make sure it would never happen again. They fortified their defenses, strengthened their walls, and formed strategic alliances. Few of them pondered the possibility that there could be any deeper significance behind it. And yet the voices of their prophets, the words of their scriptures, and an uneasy stirring in their hearts were all warning them that something was wrong. The nation had departed from God. But apart from the prophets, few realized the critical line they had crossed and the new and dangerous era they had entered. No political or military power would be strong enough to ensure their safety, only a return to God. The attack was a warning and a harbinger of judgment. So what happened after they missed their wake-up call? As time passed, it appeared as if life was gradually returning to normal. There was a respite, peace. With every passing year, it seemed as if the danger was farther behind them. But it was an illusion. The problem and the danger only increased. It was a period of grace given to them in mercy, that they might change their course and avert the judgment. But if not, then a greater judgment would come, and that first breaching of their walls would be remembered as the harbinger that was the beginning of their fall. These were their most critical of days. He paused. The seal, Noriel. Hand it to me. So I gave it to him. He lifted it up in his right hand. The first harbinger, he said, holding the seal level with my eyes. The breach. The nation that had long known blessing and security witnesses the failure of its defenses. Its walls of protection are broken through. Its national security is breached, and its illusion of invincibility shattered. The days of the harbingers begin. And this has something to do with America? I asked. America was the most blessed nation on earth, its blessings shielded by a powerful hedge of national protection. As its founders had foretold, if the nation followed the ways of God, it would be blessed not only with prosperity and power, but also with peace and security. But if America turned away from God, its protection would be removed? Yes, and so it did. And so it was. Its hedge of protection was removed, and its walls were breached. Its walls were breached when? I asked. The prophet was silent, as if waiting for me to say it, or waiting for it to hit me. And then it did, all at once. September 11th. Yes, said the prophet. The first harbinger, the breach. The nation that had so long known the blessings of peace and security witnesses its walls of protection broken through as its defenses fail. On September 11, 2001, the walls of America's national security were breached. It happened right there, he said, pointing to the sky above the waters. The second attack, that's how it came. The most powerful nation on earth and the most sophisticated defense system ever built by man, its wall of defense breached. And then came the mistake, he said. Then came the repeating of the ancient mistake. America responded to the calamity as if it were only a matter of security and defense, and nothing more. It would strengthen its national defenses and fortify its walls of protection. There was no pausing to ponder whether there could be anything of deeper significance behind it, no asking if something could be wrong, no searching of its ways. Was God behind it? I asked. Man was behind it, he answered. Evil men were behind it. Up to that point, they had been restrained, but that restraint would have its limits. As with the attack on ancient Israel, an attack would now be allowed on American soil. But it was planned by evil men, I countered. It was evil. Yes, he replied, but God can cause that which is evil to work for good. But what good? The sounding of an alarm to wake up a sleeping nation, to change its course, to save it from judgment. But then was God with America's enemies? No, no more than he was with those who attacked ancient Israel. Those who do such things are his enemies as well. God was against those who attacked America and would deal with them just as he dealt with the enemies of ancient Israel. And what about those who perished? I asked. When calamity came to ancient Israel, both the righteous and the unrighteous were touched by it. Both perished alike. The judgment was upon the nation. But that the innocent and righteous also perished in those calamities was not a matter of judgment, but of sorrow. But for the nation, the fact that such calamities could have happened in the first place was a matter of both warning and judgment. Each took place in its own realm. So it was with 9/11. The calamity took place in two different realms, the private realm of individuals and the public realm of the nation. In the first realm is only sorrow, and the magnitude of the calamity is secondary. And for those touched by it, the loss of one life is the loss of an entire world. The charge here is to bind up the broken, to comfort, to support, and to never forget the wounded and the bereaved. But the second realm is distinct and separate, centering not on the individual, but on the nation as a whole. It's in this second realm that the matter of judgment remains. It's hard to receive, I replied. Could you receive it from another? What do you mean? Abraham Lincoln. What does he have to do with... Do you know how many lives were lost in the American Civil War? I have no idea. Thousands? Hundreds of thousands. And Lincoln spoke of the calamity devastating the nation as the judgment of a righteous God, not on any individual, but on the nation as a whole. But it's a hard... Of course it is, as it was for Isaiah and Jeremiah and all the prophets and others who wept and cried out for their people. But if we fail to consider the possibility, if we avoid addressing the issue, do we not then become accountable for what follows? For what follows? I don't know, but even to say God allowed it to happen, it happened, Noriel. Therefore, it had to have been allowed to happen. That's not the question. Rather, the only question is whether it was allowed to happen for no reason or whether there was within it a redemptive purpose. On 9/11, people were asking, where was God? Where was God, he said, as if surprised by the question. We drove him out of our schools, out of our government, out of our media, out of our culture, out of our public square. We drove him out of our national life, and then we ask, where is God? Then he wasn't there? Still, he was there. He was there with those who lost their loved ones, and is still there to heal the broken and comfort those who mourn. He was there with those who gave their lives so others could live, shadows of him. And he was there as well with all the countless others who would have perished that day if not for the countless turns of details and events that saved them. And for those who perished, those who were with God in life are now with him in eternity. For these, it was not a day of national calamity, but of release. He was with them and is with them. You said something about what happened in ancient Israel after the attack, that things began to return to normal. I spoke of things appearing to return to normal. There's a difference. So was the hedge of protection back in place? To a degree and for a time. But the danger was still there. And what about America after 9/11, I asked. In the months and years after 9/11, it appeared likewise as if things had returned to some state of normalcy. As time passed, as the initial shock wore off and the trauma lessened, there was a growing temptation to go on almost as if it had never happened, as if the nation were still somehow immune to destruction. So it was in the last days of ancient Israel, but it was all an illusion. There was a long silence after that, broken only by the sound of the seagulls. Then he continued as if there had been no break. It was all a fatal illusion. So then, what of America? I didn't answer him. I don't believe he was expecting me to. After posing the question, he reached into his coat pocket to reveal another seal, which he placed into my hand. The seal of the second harbinger, he said. And what did it look like? Asked Anna. Overall, like the others, except for the images. Which were? Figures. Of what? Of men. What kind of men? I had no idea. I tried to get him to tell me by asking. So what am I looking at? It's not so hard, he replied. Give me a clue, something. Until next time, Noriel. And with that, he began to walk away. When? Next time? Where? The same time and place, he said, again without stopping to look back. Here? No. Then where and when? Wherever and whenever. Just be sure to be there. At least give me a clue to help me unlock the seal. By the ruins of an ancient people. Is that the clue? I shouted after him. Or is that where we're supposed to meet? Ah, but that would require another clue, he shouted back. Another clue? Then it was a clue about the second harbinger, and not about where we're supposed to meet, I shouted back. Perhaps, and perhaps not, he replied. He wasn't easy that way, but it was enough for me to begin searching for the meaning behind the second harbinger, a mystery to be found somewhere by the ruins of an ancient people.